I noticed some people were nodding off. But that's okay. That's still Friday night stress relief, right? Either you're meditating or you're sleeping. Still stress relieving. And is it week 10 already? Week 10? Week 11? Ooh, hard times. Hard times. I remember when it was week 10, all the assignments would... Somehow it's magically due all at the same time, right? If you're unlucky. And then we'd be staying up late at the ASB building, hoping not to get kicked out, because the security guy would come at 10 o'clock and we'd try to find another place to do our assignments. And isn't it always the case that one group member would always end up, oh, I got some other things due, and they end up passing the work to you? So it seems like an inevitable law of nature. Yes?
Did you guys all start, at the beginning or start near the end?
Oh, that's a good question. We would try to start at the beginning. We would try very, very hard. Strong determination. Start at the beginning. We've got to start. And then, you know, you put off what you can do today, you put it off tomorrow, and then turns into the next day. Somehow, work all piles up at the end. Just wondering, like, how many science students are here? Science students? Hands up. Excellent. Any engineering students? Engineering? Yeah. Law students? What have I missed? Business? Business? Commerce. So we've got a wide range of people studying different areas. And I was just reflecting on the theme of the topic and how much we've come in 2,500 years since the time of the Buddha, and how much in all aspects of our lives, in terms of engineering, in terms of science, in terms of technology and in business, everything has evolved so much. You've had the, you know, you've got all those different ages, the Iron Age, the Industrial Age, with the promise of economic wealth and prosperity. And it seems like we've come to a new age, right? What do they call it? The Information Age, right? Back in the early Industrial Revolution, there was that promise of wealth, you know. Material things will make you happy, but you know, so much hard work, okay. But now information will make you happy. You're so, you know, and information's free, right? Information's reproducible, it's easily accessible, cost of technology has gone down, and so easy to be connected with other people. And I was just wondering, as a survey of all of us here, I mean, who's got an email address, for example? Email address? I've got an email address. Anybody who doesn't have an email address? Now that's a rare person. No brave people? Okay. Who's got a mobile phone? Just as a survey. I've got a mobile phone. Who doesn't have a mobile phone? Very brave person. Anybody? No? Okay, cool. Now, who's got a mobile phone with internet? I've got it. Okay, who's got a mobile phone without internet? All right, some brave people here. Very brave. Going against the flow of the world. Very brave. And now, who's got mobile phone with internet, with email, with Facebook? I've got it. That's pretty much everybody who's got internet, right, Neely? Yes, yes. It seems like an automatic connection. Once you've got that, it's a given. You've got Facebook and all those cool apps and applications. So just a quick survey in the room clearly reveals that we're all children of technology. It's either we were born into it or we adopted it. And I might be giving away my age when, back in my days, it would be very rare that you'd have a mobile phone. And when you would have a mobile phone, just like those Hong Kong 1980s sitcoms, you know, it's like a big chunk of thing that you can kill somebody with. Not that you'd kill somebody, no, Buddhism is against killing. But And you'd have LED screens, and and yeah, it was totally different from what you would experience now. It's just so compact, and it's all color, and it's touchscreen. We didn't even have a concept of touchscreen. It was like unthinkable. Yeah, never thought about it. And my first computer was a Pentium 150. I don't know if anybody is old enough to remember a Pentium 150 with 1 gigabyte of RAM. Oh, sorry, not 1 gigabyte of RAM, 1 gigabyte of hard drive. RAM was very rare, it was like 32 megabytes. So, and now you have like a thumb drive with 4 gigabytes on it, it's so small. And that 1 gigabyte back then was the big hard disk. And then when I did my computing science degree in New Zealand, they had this thing called Moore's Law where technology would double every 16 months, I believe. Yeah. And now they've broken Moore's Law. It's quite amazing. And back then, you wouldn't have Facebook. You'd have, like, what was popular back then? What would you have? MSN? MSN? ICQ? Yeah? Okay. We're catching up now. People are catching up. Right. We had ICQ. We didn't have Facebook back then. And you'd have forums. I used to frequent a forum a lot. Being a computing science student, you know, I was quite a geek. So I had the whole range of technology. And I think I was quite fortunate because for myself, that was the avenue in which I came across Buddhism, is because I actually came across a website about Buddhism. And then something struck me. It felt like coming home. And then I downloaded more stuff. I used Google. And I read more information on the internet. And then I joined the internet forum, where I was able to discuss the Dharma with other people. And I was actually quite fortunate because there were a lot of well-practiced and well-intentioned users there who would actually share very, very good advice. And I remember distinctly when I was in Fiji, because I was quite isolated from the rest of the Sangha or the practicing community, and I could count the number of Buddhists that I knew on my, you know, right hand or left hand. You know, it's less than five Buddhists in the country of 1 million. So technology, in a way, gave me an avenue to reach out to other people through the use of the forum, and I was able to go on this website called Access to Insight. I don't know if anybody has read accesstoinsight.org, I think. So it's if you haven't, it's a really great website where you can actually access a lot of Pali suttas, which are very close to the original teachings of the Buddha. And that was where I drew a lot of my practice from. And I felt so drawn to it, I couldn't stop reading because it was so amazing for me. Because once you survey a lot of the suttas, you actually realize it brings the whole teaching to a complete circle. And for me, that was quite amazing. And then also through the use of technology, I was able to go on my first retreat. I came across an advertisement online. Oh, no, it was through a newspaper. But I searched through online, what is Vipassana? Because it was advertising, Vipassana retreat, all students required for sitting. I was like, what is Vipassana? So I Googled Vipassana, and this Vipassana retreat center came up in the top of the results. And then I was able to go on my first retreat. So a lot of things, and I feel quite fortunate, even through the use of technology, was able to, you know, allow me to practice the Dhamma and have access to the Dhamma. So my question is, you know, so much technology has changed. There are ways that you can utilize and make use of it, you know, to your benefit. But my question is, can too much of technology be a bad thing? You know? And I was actually reading, listening to a TED Talk, and I found it really, really compelling. Because it seems like a paradox for me, as a former a computing science student, here to talk about the disadvantages of technology, or just even to weigh in and, you know, start asking questions, is it skillful, is it unskillful, and whether too much of it can be a problem. The lady's name is Sherry Turkle, and she talks about it because she's a behavioral scientist. So she studies online usage, and she talks about technology and internet especially, because it not only changes how we do things in terms of tasks and you know, things we do to get things done, but it also changes who we are. I mean, for the first one, no doubt, the nature of our work has also changed. It's no longer, you know, we're cranking widgets, we're making things, you know, we're not farming the land. And I doubt, and no doubt all of us here, maybe 99% of us when we go out, a lot of the work will be, you know, mental. We have to apply our mind to the work we have in front of us. So the nature of work has changed too. And technology, through its rapid advancement, she argues, changes who we are because it changes our mind. And I think the most striking of all is, you know, through this little funny device that fits into our hand and into our pocket. Because, and even I'm very, very guilty of it. Who sleeps with their phone? Not with them, but, you know, next to their bedside. Just in case the alarm rings or someone texts. Or, I know, we're all guilty of it. We text and we Facebook, we look up the news in our beds while we're driving, while we are friends, and especially while we are with friends. I mean, why? And I find it so strange, because you're with friends to connect with other people, but then at the same time you're terribly antisocial. It's like, yeah, nice hanging out with you, and then you're texting away. And even she gave the example where people text and Facebook at funerals to deal with their grief. And it's really, really striking, because it's changed the whole dynamics of how we behave with other people. And I feel, most importantly, how we deal with ourselves. She says, she calls it being all alone together. It's a paradox, isn't it? We're connected, we're all together, but yet we're all alone. And it just reminds me of a story, because I was on an audit, I work as an auditor, and I was talking with a senior executive, and I asked how his holiday was, and he said, oh yeah, that was great, we went up to the Northern Rivers, up north New South Wales, but he could not stop talking about his son, and he was saying how his son, because his dad pays for the bills, right? His son had like 10,000 texts a month. Can you imagine that? 10,000 texts a month. I just find it so unimaginable how someone can generate that much texts in one day. So you have to be like LOLing, smiley facing every 5 minutes, right? But yeah, he was talking about how disconnected he felt from his son, because even though he was with his son really wasn't there. And he felt, and I could see almost a sense of grief, like he's lost somebody. And I don't know if we can be honest with ourselves and see actually whether it applies to our own lives too, you know, how disconnected we are with our friends, with our families, and to people that really matter to us. And for us, it doesn't really matter that much because we're adults, right? But how about kids nowadays? I mean, my little nephews, they're like 3 years old and they're like going away at the iPad, much better than their dads. And I find it so amazing. And I just remember my little nephew who was like 4 years old back then. He was able to work the video camera on the camera phone, and he knew exactly the moment to press when his mom got angry at 4 years old. And then when the mom would get angry again, he'd replay it back to her. See, mom, this is what you are like when you're angry. So amazing, kids, and that ability to develop their mind. But what are we doing to our kids, you know, like in terms of their mental development? How are they able to develop that social skill that's really required, you know, as a young adult to actually grow up? So you wonder, why is it so appealing? Why are we so connected all the time? Because maybe because we get to edit, we get to copy and paste, we are able to control our response. But that at the same time, when we do that, we sacrifice the possibility of a connection. We sacrifice the possibility of a conversation. And you really wonder, you know, all these texts, all these Facebook posts, does it really add up to a proper conversation? Anything meaningful? I mean, for me, I find it very hard to gather a real meaning behind what somebody has to say in a whole day's worth of, even a whole week's worth of Facebook posts, you know? It seems like disconnected, disjointed, random thoughts, as outrageous as possible. As you know, and it seems, I don't know, it seems compromising because it reduces your capacity for self-reflection. I mean, you are expressing, but you know, how close are you with that person when you read that Facebook post? And as a former, you know, addict myself, it seems like technology appeals to people where we are most vulnerable. That idea that we want to be connected, the idea that we want to be heard. And she talks about, and it really, really struck me, because she talks about the three fantasies of how we are connected. The first fantasy, which is not very far from the truth, is we can put our attentions wherever we want. Right, we can put our attentions wherever we want. In Buddhist terms, we can put our minds wherever we want. One moment, you're reading about, you're on the moon, you're reading about, on Wikipedia, for example, you're reading about, all right, this is the structure of the moon. The next minute, you click on a random link, then your mind is already transported, you know, to this holiday beach in Hawaii that you've been craving to go to, or this holiday in Malaysia that you've been wanting to go to. And then you see another picture of this lovely satay, and then you click into that. And then your mind, oh see, Kendrick's already hungry, right? So as fast as your mind can think it, the internet and all its possibilities with its technologies allow your mind to go wherever you want. And it's very easy to get lost in that fantasy, because here you are, you have this body, you have this mind, but your mind is already not with you, it's already gone. And the next thing you know, oh, damn, it's like 1 a.m., I have to go to sleep. What have I been doing for the past 4 hours? I mean, can you relate to that? I can relate to that. It's like, it's yeah, and it's become our way of life, exactly. It's become our way of life. But we live under this constant illusion that we can put our attentions wherever we want. But my question is, are we neglecting something? We are putting our attentions anywhere we want, except for the present moment, except for where we are right here, right now. And that is very important, because the idea and the possibility of change, of mental cultivation, of practice, is only right here, right now. And every moment that you waste where on this fantasy or that fantasy is a moment that's lost, it cannot be gained. Even $100 million in this world cannot buy you that 4 hours that you've lost. And it's true. So that's the first fantasy. The second fantasy is that we are always being heard. That we will always be heard. Now this is not so relevant with some technologies, but I think it's more relevant to something like Facebook, yeah, where people keep on posting. It's like, do you have friends who keep on posting random things that make no sense? You have Google links, you have, you know, it's like YouTube videos and that and this and that, and they talk about, oh, what I had for lunch. I don't know, what else people post about? It seems like there is that very, very deep connection. On a very deep level, there is this basic instinct that we want to have a conversation. We crave to be liked. whether it's a Facebook like, like, or a real life like. See, I'm speaking the lingo, right? And it's easy to live in that fantasy. I mean, just as a quick survey, who's got Facebook, right? Facebook? Okay. Who's got more than 500 friends? No? I don't have 500 friends. Okay. Now, how many of them do you actually see in the space of 1 week? Less than 20? No, not even 10. 20?
Well, I guess it adds up from like high school to now.
Okay. So,
yeah.
So, but how many of them do you actually see in a week? Yeah, okay, okay, but you get my point, right? You get my point. Oh, Kendrick's doing that. Less than 10. But it seems like we're addicted to being connected. I mean, addiction is a very strong word, right? But, you know, we usually reserve it for drug addicts, alcohol addicts, gambling addicts, but there is this new category of Facebook addicts. Yeah, and it's really funny for me because I have friends on Facebook who can't keep posting, and it's never like that. You know them in real life, but you know, and you notice how they're so different from how they're posting. And when you actually know them in real life, it seems like totally different. In real life, they're very quiet, they're very well mannered, very well reserved. But on Facebook, they turn into a totally different person. They're a party animal, they're an online activist. And that's, I guess, another part of the appeal. We can choose however we want to be. That is that possibility, right? Technology has promised us, the internet has promised us. With the idea of being an online avatar, you can create a second life. There is a game called Second Life online, and people find it so, so addictive. Similarly with, I think it's called World of Warcraft. Right, we're getting some laughs and smiles here. Excellent. So it's the idea that you can live a second life, but how close is it to the truth? I mean, you hear about people who, I think I read about this story about this guy in Korea. He died from playing video games for how many days straight? I just found it so amazing. And I know addiction is a strong word, but hey, when somebody loses their life over a video game or online, you know, thing, it's like deep down this guy has issues. No doubt. So that's the second thing. I mean, as an observation, we want to be heard, we want to be connected. The first one is on a deep level we can choose where we want to place our attention. On the second aspect, we want to be heard. And the third aspect is the illusion that we are never alone. And I think I'm very guilty of it too, because whenever we find time to be alone, what is the automatic reaction, right? We reach for the phone. We reach for the phone. We either check our emails. For me, I check my Sydney Morning Herald. As if the world will change in the space of 1 hour, right? Obviously it won't. But it seems like we are so used to it now, whether we are born into it, whether we adopted it, we are so used to the illusion that we are never alone. And it appeals to us because on a deep down level, we want to be connected. Now, and then what happens when the battery dies? Oh, suffering, right? Suffering, you get so agitated. It actually happened to me one day. I left my phone at home. And then I was like, oh my God, what if work calls? What if, you know, so-and-so calls? What if I get an email? And then I went through this whole process. Once arriving at work, I emailed people I knew, my loved ones. Oh, please be careful. I left my phone at home. You know, in any event that you need to contact me, please email me or here's my work number, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then so much agitation, so much angst. And then after a while, I don't know, I felt a sense of relief. I don't know why, but the idea that for a moment, I didn't have to check my email on my phone. I didn't have to check my Facebook. I didn't have to check my news. in that day, in that short span of one day, I actually felt relief. Believe it or not, I actually felt relief that I didn't have to check my phone so often. But yeah, there is that illusion that we are never alone, and being so accessible, I think, and it's so easily accessible, reinforces that. Now, what's the danger in all of these three things, right? You might think, oh, well, Zen, you're seriously stepping beyond your line now, you're out of line. What is the danger of Facebook? You're crazy, right? This is purely crazy talk, right? Zen's not making any sense. But what is the danger in all of this, right? The Buddha talked about karma, talks about action. Now, he said, through repeated action, we form our habits and our conditioning. And it might not be a very big sort of monumental action. You're not killing a living being, or you're not killing the Buddha, or you're not, you know, you're not doing anything really drastic, you know. But through repeated actions, no matter how big or small, the Buddha says we are conditioning our mind. And how are we conditioning our mind? And as an example of that, I don't know if people still remember back when Internet Explorer was still the king, and there was no multi-tab browsing, right? You had only one screen. And it was such a revelation for me when you had multiple screens, right? You could multi-tab the whole thing, so you click all the links. So then, when I first got it, as an example, when I first got multi-tab, I just kept on loading links in the background, and then when I got into the second page, I would load more links because, you know, my mind was working that fast. It was jumping from this page to that page to that page to that page. And that's just an example. How we are conditioning our mind is that we are jumping all over the place. We are so distracted. And what is the result of that? Our minds are so agitated. So agitated. Whenever we have a discretionary amount of time, our minds are jumping all over the place, just as we have been jumping all over the place on our phones. And it's a silent trauma, it's a silent epidemic we are all experiencing. You might not even realize it, but we are all silent victims of this thing called Facebook, internet, and technology. And it extends to all facets of our lives, not only when we are connected on the phone, when we're dealing with relationships, with friends, with our work, our minds are jumping all over the place. And that is the effect, that is the karma that we create. In essence, our minds have become so fickle, so fickle. It's like, you know how the corn, you have corn stalks, and you have it's so easy to break the corn stalks. You know how people make crop circles using corn stalks? Well, basically, it's just very easy. You can just walk through it. Our minds have just become like that. It's just so easily swayed by the wind. Which way the wind blows, the corn will fall. So it's just swaying in the wind. But whichever website you come across, you know, you're jumping here and there, swaying with the wind, swaying with the wind. So our minds have develop this inability to persist, to actually stay on one object. And to be actually mindful of that object is another issue. It's so hard, because our mindfulness has really diminished, because we are so used to jumping around all the time. So that underpins a lot of the stress, I feel, a lot of the anxiety that we feel in our lives. Because our minds, as a result of technology, has become unable to be comfortable with the present moment, to be mindfully aware of what's happening in our mind. And because of repeated action, repeated mental action, we have formed this habit and character. Now you might think, oh, it's not that important really, right? But I might give you the simile of how rivers form, right? Initially, rivers don't form that way. It's formed by a single drop right from the upper mountains, right? That single drop falls through, and then you have more drops, more drops, more drops. Eventually, you have a river. And that river might not even start as a river. It might be a creek. It cuts through the soil. And that creek grows into a wider stream. It not only cuts through soil now, it can slowly wear away rock. And eventually, that's how Grand Canyon was formed. It was all water. It cut through that huge amount of rock. So you might think, oh, it's a small thing. But yeah, through repeated action, it becomes a very big thing. So that's one aspect I think technology has really affected us. And I think really that's the major, major crux of what I wanted to say. How it also has affected us is also in terms of how we practice our precepts. Now, anybody here can give me what the five precepts are? No killing, no stealing, sexual misconduct. Yeah, maybe no false speech, yeah?
Yeah, I could say.
Yeah, wrong speech, and then intoxicant. Now, it's not that it's no, it's not like right or wrong. It's the Buddha described it as what is skillful and unskillful. Now, back then, it was very easy to define what was black and white, right? But now, I think with technology, it's a bit different. I mean, it's hard to kill somebody with technology, right? But the second precept, I think, is the most is one of the things, like no stealing. Now, how do you define what's not taking what is not given? I mean, some of you might know somebody who downloads software. Not you, right? You might know somebody who downloads software. Yeah. Oh, you might know somebody who downloads TV shows, right? TV shows are not stealing. It's like, I get to watch TV anyway. I'm just watching it in my own time, right? Right. It's not that it's wrong, but the Buddha asked you, is it skillful or unskillful? Is it really? I mean, if you think it's not wrong, that's fine. But I asked, and I experienced it for myself, being a computing science student, you know, like back then. Back then, we didn't have BitTorrent. We had Kazaa and Napster and all those, you know, old-fashioned names, LimeWire. So, yeah, really revealing my age here. But yeah, I mean, for me, I really rationalized. Oh, well, it's not really stealing, you know, digital information is free, no one's getting hurt. You know, these guys have a lot of money anyway, you know, Sony Pictures, they don't need my poor students' money. Yeah, I used to rationalize it. But then, you know, at the end of the day, it's something in the back of my mind told me, maybe not the most skillful thing to do. There was this little voice in the back of my mind. But, you know, and I'm really just opening this to conversation because, you know, technology is so new to us, and you know, how we define what is a precept, what is skillful and unskillful is really open to debate and discussion for gray areas like this. But as opening it to the floor, and I don't want only this to be a Dhamma talk, I want this to be a Dhamma discussion. You know, is that skillful or unskillful? You know, so it's an open question, maybe we can all discuss at the end of the talk. But that's one aspect. So to refrain from the practice of not taking what is not given. Yeah? Not necessarily stealing. I think the phrasing used in the Pali Suttas is actually that, refrain from not taking what is not given. And needless to say, for the third precept, sexual misconduct, if you might not know, because I am a computing science student, and I know that pornography is the biggest business on the internet. In case you didn't know, it is the biggest business on the internet. That's what drove the whole internet revolution. So, you know, what do you define what is sexual misconduct or not? Is it looking at dirty pictures? Is it just looking at half dirty pictures? I don't know. I'm really opening this to to the floor. Is that a skillful thing to do? Is it an unskillful thing to do? But my question is, how does it affect the quality of your mind when you sit down to meditate? Or when you sit down and you have nothing else, is your mind agitated? Is it calm? Is it collected? Or is it full of lust and anxiety or disturbance might not be a direct result of that, but you know, all these visual images that we feed our brain, it has an impact. You know, the Buddha talks about it. Whatever comes in contact with our senses, and if we are not mindful, we crave and we cling to it. And the more we crave and the more we cling, there is suffering. That's what the Buddha taught. So that's the third precept, which I really want to discuss and open to the floor. And now the really, really, really big one, the fourth precept, you know, to refrain from speaking of what is unskillful, you know. And I think a lot of us are quite guilty on Facebook or, you know, in email. We don't lie by omission, but we exaggerate the truth, right? We exaggerate the truth to a large extent. We paint ourselves bigger than life, bigger than life, much bigger than life online. And as a component of right speech, right, it's no idle talk and gossip. And how much of that do we engage on Facebook, I wonder, of idle talk and gossip? Not that it's wrong, the Buddha didn't say it's wrong, but he asked you what is skillful and what is unskillful, whether it actually leads to your own welfare and happiness. How, and in a way, I think it's really, really empowering if you really think about it. He didn't give you a commandment. He didn't say, this is right, that is wrong. He said, know for yourself, develop the wisdom for yourself through your own experience, what is right and what is wrong, what is skillful and what is unskillful action. And in a way, he empowers you to take control of your own lives, to actually see things as they arise, to develop the discerning wisdom to actually know for yourself. So, you know, it's quite powerful, I think, in terms of what the Buddha taught. So really, that's how much I wanted to present today. I mean, the impact of technology in our lives, in terms of how it's affected how we think, the quality of our minds, and also in terms of how we practice the precepts. I think it's quite relevant in terms of how we live our daily lives, because technology is so pervasive. It encompasses all aspects of our lives. And now I'm not the person to say that, oh well, you know, run off to the hills altogether, right? And I'm not the person to say, well, you should take all of it in and, you know, be that person that you want to be online, you know, play World of Warcraft for 4 days straight and, you know, don't go to the bathroom. But, you know, where is the middle path? Where is a solution to all of that? So, I don't know. I'd like to maybe open that to the floor. But I think a few of my thoughts is what the Buddha taught is actually to actually understand suffering, to understand discontent. And I think what we are experiencing a lot with technology is that our minds have become so unsettled and so, you know, fickle. There's a lot of wanting and craving. Now with internet, your mind, like I said, your mind can be wherever you want to be. And we need to understand it. We actually need to look into the reality of the situation. Take a step back, you know, see our own lives, see the results of that. How much of our time is wasted. And to actually understand that there is the cause of the suffering, which is actually our own craving, our own wanting. Very, very deep down inside, we might not even not realize it, there is that wanting. Either wanting to be popular, wanting to be heard, wanting to reinforce the sense of self that is me, you know. Or just simply wanting for the sake of wanting. I don't know if you experienced it. For me, when I go online, I think, oh yeah, I should get that iPad, that new iPad. Really, really, it's really great. I can do that, do this, do that. And then the next thing, oh, I really need to get that GPS. Yeah, it's really, really useful. And then I rationalize all this. But it's just wanting for the sake of wanting. And now you can have it in an instant, you know, with your credit card, just punch in the details, they'll deliver to you at home. So, you know, the Buddha recommends, look into the cause of it. What is the cause of our discontent, this this materialistic lives that we lead, it's because of wanting. And what is the third noble truth? Well, there is a possibility that there can be an end to this. And how do we achieve it? You know, that strong grasping, we learn to let go. We learn to put down, literally and figuratively, we learn to put down what has implicitly, very, very silently, it's crept behind us, and it's encompassed our lives, it's taken control of our lives, but it is not the technology that's encompassed our lives, but it is us who have clung on to it very, very, very strongly, very, very deeply. So learning to let go by using our discerning wisdom to actually see the suffering, the discontent that exists, to see the cause of that suffering, and to actually know that there is an end to it. If you actually learn to practice, and you can practice by learning to let go and developing the path. I mean, the whole idea of the precepts is actually to develop the path. Not only meditation, even precepts allow you to develop the path. Maybe the next time you might think, oh, I really want to download that show, but okay, I'll practice a bit of restraint this time, you know? And you actually realize you feel good, you really feel good. You feel good that you've practiced the precepts. And through positive reinforcement by practice. And it's not because I say so, don't believe me because I say so, don't believe, you know, anybody else because they said so. But know for yourself, that's what the Buddha said, try and see the results. See if it actually works. Next time you want to post something, you know, random miscellaneous on Facebook, well, think, okay, I will try to post something proper. You know, maybe, or maybe even the best action could be to refrain. You know, just see how it feels like. See if it actually works. The thing with craving, I think, on a general level of defilements, is it's very tricky. We can see anger very easily, right? Anger is very apparent. We become distorted, we become a monster, our face turns red, people go, "Hey, you're angry, stay away from me." Right? But it's very hard to see craving. It's very, very hard to see craving. Because why do you think it's so hard to see craving? I'm just wondering. Yeah, you keep it inside, that's a good point. It's very subtle, yeah? It's very subtle, very subtle. I tell you why it's very hard to see craving? Because it feels good. It feels very, very good. And I want it to last forever, and ever, and ever, and ever. And not stop. And it feels really, really good, yeah. And it's a very short-term pleasure. That craving gives me a kick. It gives me a kick when I buy something online. It might give you a kick to post something funny online and get 20 likes, you know? It's very, very subtle. And then you get your hit, your high, and then you want to get happy, you want to get, you know, high again. You try to post something outrageous, something funny, you try to buy something else online, you try to distract yourself. So it's very, very subtle. And I really like it when a Thai meditation master talked about craving as being a baited hook. Anybody who goes fishing here? Okay, good. We're all Buddhists, we don't kill fish, right? But it's like a baited hook. You have the hook, which is very, very sharp, and you've got a nice, yummy piece of bread that the fish can't see, right? And how do you catch the fish? The fish is our minds, our poor selves. We think it's a very pleasurable experience, and we latch onto it. But little do we know, there is a hook, there is a catch. Everything has a catch behind it. And we get yanked out of the water and we suffer. And it's really, really true. I really like that description. So to actually see with wisdom, to know, all right, I know there is that bait for me. It's coming up on the periphery of my vision. It's Facebook time. But just know it. And it's all right to make fun of your own mind. You know, it's like, and it's a good way to reflect, give you a way to self-reflect too. And actually, by doing that, you see the drawbacks. Well, you know, I really have better use of my time than doing this. I could be studying. I could be having real conversations with friends. I could be actually meditating or learning about the Dhamma, you know? So seeing the drawbacks, I think, of the bait, so to speak, helps to deal with craving, I find, on a personal level. And when you actually refrain from craving, you actually feel good when you actually learn to have sense restraint. Actually, that's another thing that can help you, is actually to develop that restraint. Develop the idea of solitude. I know it's very rare because, you know, we've got so many friends, we feel so connected, but the idea of solitude is also very useful to develop that calmness of mind. Now, the Buddha talked about solitudes in two different ways. There is Kaya Viveka in Pali. He talked about the physical seclusion of the body. So you remove your body, you go to a forest, you go to a pond, you go to a mountain, you go to a lake, and there is that physical seclusion. Now that in itself, I mean, feels really nice, right? Why does it feel so nice? I mean, who likes going out to the forest? Who likes going out to nature? I do. I mean, I don't know about you. Some people might not like going because there's no Facebook there, right? So, but yeah, why does it feel so good? It's because there is that emptiness, there is that lack of disturbance. You might not know it, but yeah, it is that. So the Buddha talked about physical seclusion. He said it's great for your practice, it's great for your own calmness of mind, because you can actually feel and see the benefits of it, and you actually get to practice meditation. Now, he talked about another type of seclusion, citta viveka in Pali. It means the seclusion of your mind. So you can actually, and he actually, there was a story of a monk who was actually physically excluded. He was actually practicing in the forest, and he was talking about the benefits of all being in seclusion, it's so nice, so lovely, there is that bliss. Yeah, but the Buddha came and reprimanded him. He said, there is the physical seclusion, but even then, when you sit down and meditate in physical seclusion, there is your mind still churning away. I can see the defilements in your mind. And he talked about the benefits of mental seclusion. And that, I think, is where we can leverage off a lot of our practice from. To actually develop that sense restraint, to actually say, oh, right, the skillful thing for me to do is maybe not turn on the computer now. Maybe the skillful thing to do is not turn on that laptop now, not turn on the TV now. Because you can actually develop that mental seclusion, because your senses are not impacted, particularly your five senses, but your mind sense too, yeah? So, from practicing virtue, I can only encourage you to try and see it for yourself. You get the bliss of blamelessness. The Buddha called it the bliss of blamelessness. It means that your mind is free from anything that would disturb you, in terms of agitation, in terms of doubt, in terms of annoyance, anger, craving. That bliss of blamelessness when you practice virtue, when you practice sense restraint. Now when you cultivate meditation and you actually try to seclude yourself, restrain your senses, there is this bliss of meditation. And it really feels great. I mean, it really drives my practice to be able to meditate, because for me, it really feels nice. And I feel the benefits of it in my life every day. And in a way, I've developed that ability to say, no, well, I don't need to pick that up now. You know, it's through repeated practice that you might have to try this. You might not get it the first time. I mean, it's like riding a bicycle. Nobody got on a bicycle at the age of 5 and rode off into the sunset, right? Nobody did that. We all fell down, we got hurt. And that's the idea of practice, is that it is a practice. It's not perfection on first go. You fall off, you get on. Fall off, you get on. So anyways, those are my thoughts for this evening. I know it's a very, very short Dhamma talk, but I really want to ask questions, and if there's any questions from the floor, if anybody might want to discuss anything. And I'm really interested in hearing what you have to say about what we've discussed so far. If it really applies to your life or not. Exactly.
But people forgot that part of the eightfold, the noble eightfold path is actually morality, which is Sam has mentioned about. And the benefit of it also is that it's mentioned, and I think people overlook because people might think that, you know, it's such a mundane thing to do. But if you think about it, it's not that easy to practice in a deeper level. We have many levels of practicing morality. There's in a behavioral level where you do it through your action, and there's a mind level where you do it through your intention. And I think the benefit, like the Buddha said, the blissfulness from morality comes from the mind. When you have this very good moral intention behind it, that's when you get the bliss from the morality. And I think I just want to emphasize that. I want to encourage people to really practice in a deeper level to see the benefit.
Thank you for that. I agree. Questions, comments?
What was that website you mentioned that you went to?
Oh yeah. There is an iPhone. There is an iPhone app, by the way. It is very, very good. This is a rare occasion where you see me advocating an app, but it's really good. We're so consumer driven, aren't we? I mean, we think that buying things would make us happy. We've been made to believe that buying things will make you happy, but very far from the truth. Well, you guys should know better by now, right? We're all good practitioners. Yes? I think it depends on your intention behind it. And I myself downloaded a book with the intention to buy it. So I actually bought the physical book after I downloaded that copy of it. So I don't think, if your intentions are good, then I don't think there's an issue with that. But then, you know, I know some people who see like a whole website of free books and they download everything. So, you know, it's like a hungry ghost all over again. You know what a hungry ghost in the Pali Suttas? Hungry ghost is like a ghost that keeps on eating but it cannot get full. Or they've got a very small mouth and a very big stomach. They try to eat as much as they can but they can't get full. But anyways, that's beside the point. I think, yeah, like you said, if you intend to buy it, I feel that wouldn't present an issue because your intentions are good. Yes. Yes.
Similar to that website, access to website, now that it's in the iPhone app.
Yep.
Do you find
Yeah.
Besides all the disadvantages.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
I think it's answers as well.
Well, I think the very fact that I'm here with you today is the result of technology. I got an email from Kendrick. When I didn't reply to the email, he texted me. When I didn't reply to the text on time, he called me. Within the space of 1 hour, by the way, I think. One and a half hours. So the very fact that I'm here today with you right now is the result of technology. But and also because, as I mentioned earlier, my Dhamma practice in the beginning was all driven by online media. I was able to access an online Sangha. I read the Pali Suttas on that website. And so I think, yeah, there are also benefits. Just like fire has benefits. You can use it to cook your food, or you can get burnt by it. So, depends on how skillful and wise we are. Are we wise enough to use it as fuel to cook our food? Or do we go hugging it like it's our best friend and get burnt? There is, I think, a great potential for Buddhism to grow. It's a great avenue. But we also have to recognize the limitations in that. The limitations of, for me personally, when I was studying the suttas, is that you get quite attached to concepts and ideas because you don't have a person to talk to who's, you know, like a real person you can see and observe their behavior. Or you can get advice and meditation advice from, you know. So there is that limitation, I have to admit, is there. So the Buddha talked about the requisites for enlightenment, and he said, you know, it has to be the words of another. Well, if you're listening to the Dhamma and you get enlightened, it has to be the words of another and appropriate attention. So he used that term, words of another. So, and he also talked about the importance of good friendship, real friendship. He told Ananda, good friendship is not half of the holy life, the practice. It is the whole of the practice, to be able to share it with Dhamma friends and Dhamma companions. Because we are all habitual, we are all communal beings. We learn from seeing others. Others learn by seeing you. So there is that limitation, I think. But I think as an avenue to spread Buddhism and for people to come across it as a web, literally and figuratively speaking, to catch people. Yeah, I think it's great. Well said. Any other questions? Comments? If we still have time, I'd like to do a short meditation session. Don't worry, not too long. 5-10 minutes. It's good for you.